Weed and ask CEO Mike Duke, board member Lee Scott, and vice chairman Eduardo Castro Wright. While Walmart's massive bribery payments took place in Mexico, the corruption emanated from the very top of corporate headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas. It stems directly from Walmart's ruling ethic of ruthless expansion and profit at all costs, pressuring managers to achieve, quote, very aggressive growth goals by doing whatever was necessary. A decade ago, when Mr. Castro Wright was head of Walmart's operations in Mexico, he decided that necessary included unbridled bribery. He began doling out some $24 million to Mexican officials, clearing Walmart's path for rapid domination of Mexico's retail market. As early as 2005, this was known and condoned by corporate chieftains in Bentonville, including then-CEO Scott and Duke, who oversaw all international divisions at the time. So, what happened? Far from stopping the corrupt payments, Scott killed an internal inquiry into the corruption by turning it over to, guess who? Castro Wright. Yes, the very same man pushing the illegality. The bribes continued. Castro Wright was promoted to vice chairman. Scott retired with a golden pension and a multimillion-dollar fortune, and Duke was elevated to CEO, now drawing $18 million a year in pay. This is Jim Hightower saying, Walmart's executives are stinkier than a whole den of skunks could ever be.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a 20-year green health journalist. I blog on the Huffington Post. I'm the author of an upcoming book. And I'm also very active on Facebook and social media in conversations around activism to protect our health and ecology and habitat. On Connect the Dots every week, we connect the dots between our personal health and choices and the ways those affect the total health environment and planetary balance. That means looking not just at our personal choices, but also at the social policies of our society and the health of our communities. And so this really gives me a very broad palette to bring to you some terrific leaders, thought leaders, and experts in all of these different realms that connect to our health, well-being, and life on planet Earth. So that's what you'll hear every week, Wednesdays at 10, on Connect the Dots. This week I have a very special show for you with a very special guest, and as regular listeners know, I begin the hour with action and event opportunities. And this week we actually have a couple that are just terrific before we get to our guest. Coming up this next weekend, if you're in the New York area, New York City's largest grassroots food conference is happening this weekend, this Saturday, May 12th, in Brooklyn. Over 5,000 people are expected. It only happens once every 2 years. This is a great opportunity for foodies, people who care about food, healthy agriculture, food justice, food access, and all of those other things, that because food is really fundamental to our lives and our health. It's going to be taking place between 9 and 6 p.m. again on Saturday, May 12th, at Brooklyn Technical High School. To find out more about it, you can go to bkfoodconference.org. That's B as in boy, K as in kitty cat, conference.org. And there's a full roster with over 100 different programs and events. There's going to be fantastic sustainable food there, a whole bunch of suppliers and organizations and groups in the area. And I've been part of the programming of this conference, and I strongly encourage people to attend, because this is actually a very tangible way to really support health and support the environment, because our food is one of the major connecting links. I also am happy to say that I'm going to be moderating two panels at the conference, and I, you know, invite listeners to come to the panels and come up and introduce yourselves to me. I'd love to meet you, actually. The two panels, the first is occurring at 11 o'clock. It's called Don't Frack with My Carrot. It features fracking, a theme I've covered a great deal on this program, and they're going to be leaders of fractivist organizations to protect our water and food supply, as well as scientists with research studies that show how upstate, how fracking chemicals really can get into and do get into the food supply, because New York is poised to be overtaken by gas and oil companies to frack our region. This is really very relevant both to New York's water, which has been discussed a great deal, as well as to our upstate food supply. And so we'll hear from leaders and scientists about the real danger to our foods. It's, the panel's called Don't Frack with My Carrot. It's at 11 a.m. at the Brooklyn Food Conference this Saturday. My second panel will be occurring at 3:15, and it's about the California Labeling Initiative against GMOs, so that people really have the opportunity to know what foods they're eating and if those foods contain GMOs. Again, we're going to have leaders from Food Democracy Now!, which has been one of the primary movers to protect our health against from GMOs. Dave Murphy and Lisa Saki will be joining me, as well as some people from Nature's Path, a committed organization, a committed company that's helping in the California Labeling Initiative. You'll find out about GMOs, why labeling is so important, and what you can do. So that's happening at 3:15 at the Brooklyn Food Conference. For a full schedule, please go to bkfoodconference.org. Our second featured event is coming up on May 15th, and so that's next week. It's a Tuesday. Mark it on your calendars. It's a rally in Albany, to benefit the new New Yorkers Against Fracking coalition of all the major grassroots fracking groups, anti-fracking groups here in the Northeast region. It's occurring in Albany to send a message to Governor Cuomo. We all know that he's running for president, and we know the kinds of large organizations and companies and corporations that contribute under the table, you know, and now secretly, to political campaigns. So without health, environmental, or even socioeconomic studies, fracking is being fast-tracked into New York State by a governor with presidential ambitions and the kinds of friends that come along with those ambitions. This, as we'll cover in my fracking panel at the food conference, really affects downstate people, upstate people. It affects the whole region. And New Yorkers Against Fracking have really made it kind of, this is a very fun one to go to if you're not used to going to rallies, because it's a multimedia concert event that will feature Natalie Merchant, Joan Osborne, Mark Ruffalo, and Melissa Leo. So this is a great one to go to. You can get ticket information online at theegg.org. And you can find out more about New Yorkers Against Fracking online and about this rally. And they have an absolutely terrific poster in which we see the Statue of Liberty sort of punching out the people that want to infringe on, you know, our water and food and air. It's actually a fantastic poster. I hope they do a T-shirt of it. It would definitely be a must-have. So to go to find out more, again, you can go to theegg.org or to newyorkersagainstfracking.org. So thank you for listening and taking action. I always like to provide direct opportunities for action. And now, we're going to be going on to talk with our guest about the limitations, you know, the upsides and the downsides, the kind of limitations in, you know, the kind of personal health choices that we make. And so, you know, we've kind of been led to think that, you know, our power lies in our consumer purchases, and yet the author of the book I'm going to be featuring today says we're not going far enough. So I want to welcome to Connect the Dots Kendra Pierre-Louis, the author of the new book Greenwashed. Greenwashed, and her subtitle is also pretty terrific, Why We Can't Buy Our Way to a Green Planet. And in the book, she dispels some of our sort of most cherished hopes and myths about, you know, how individual consumer product purchases can make all the difference, and really points us in another direction. So we'll learn about that all day on this show. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Kendra Pierre-Louis.
Hi, Allison. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so happy to. I think this is such an important topic. Can you first tell our listeners and me, how did you come to write this book? What awoke you to this theme?
It's kind of funny. I was working for a sustainable design company at the time, and I looked around the office, and I noticed that we all had sort of the fancy stainless steel water bottles that are really trendy right now. Mm-hmm. And I was laughing because I was on my, like, fourth water bottle, I think, because I kept losing them. And I started thinking, it can't possibly be that great for the environment for me to buy these durable water bottles and then stop using them because I've lost them, and then have to buy bottled water for a while until I get around to buying a new one. And I sort of wanted to look at sort of the patterns of our consumption that are supposedly sustainable, but, you know, when sort of embedded within this larger system that makes it, you know, water bottles are relatively cheap, especially now the prices have come down quite a bit. So if you lose one, it's not necessarily the end of the world. And so, sort of like tying that into our larger consumption. That's what got me started anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is your background and training, just for our listeners?
Sure. I have a bachelor's in economics from Cornell University. I have a master's degree in sustainable development from the SIT Graduate Institute. I've worked for a number of sustainability organizations, including the United Nations Environmental Programs, Convention on Biological Diversity, the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation at the American Museum of Natural History, the New York Botanical Garden.
And it goes on. You have a terrific background. Yeah, you have a terrific background to really take a step back and do a bigger picture analysis. You know, I just want to share with you, I come out of, I'm basically one of the senior reporters on integrative health, and I've been doing it for over 2 decades. And so, you know, I was very much throughout my career, very much in the world of here's what we can do, here's the healthy thing to eat, here's the healthy thing to buy, here's the not healthy thing that you shouldn't buy, and all of that kind of thing, until I basically widened my lens and began looking at the bigger picture in some of these issues, and to see that a lot of these ecological damage that we're creating, a lot of the toxicity in our world, cannot be avoided merely by, you know, my choice not to use a home cleaner, even though that's a good place to start, you know, and to use another kind of home cleaner or whatever. And so there is, in a sense, we've all been told, and media, which I've been part of, you know, for my whole professional life here, tells us all the time, you know, you can't actually even write a book that doesn't tell people what they can do. Because, you know, unless they can, there's something that they can do at home, you know, that's the only thing that people have the bandwidth for or wish to hear, and that excludes, you know, taking any kind of social action. So that goes over into the green area, where it's all about what we can do, you know, just as individual consumers. Why? So, you know, I have some sense of how we got to the mindset of just excluding our sense of opportunity or efficacy merely to consumer purchases. And, of course, it serves companies to just keep pipelining us stuff and have us thinking that way. So, you know, what are the most common, you know, things that we can do that are supposed to help us be healthier, help us be greener, that, you know, that actually aren't as effective as, you know, aren't accomplishing the purpose that we're seeking?
Okay, so one of the, I guess one of the things that I sort of take down in the book is sort of the myth of the green automobile, whether it be a hybrid electric vehicle like the Prius or a pure electric vehicle like the Nissan Leaf. Mm-hmm. And I think what's over the past 10 years or so, there's been this larger conversation about cars and fuel efficiency, which is very much grounded in the idea of peak oil and the effects of carbon emissions on climate change, all of which are really valid. But by focusing so narrowly on exactly the kind of automobile that we're driving, we're not taking a step back and looking at sort of the larger picture. For example, I talk about in the book how one of the largest areas that's currently being, where roads are being expanded, are the areas outside of Detroit. Now, Detroit is a dying city in many ways. The population is declining. But the suburbs around Detroit actually have an increasing population because all of the people who are leaving Detroit great. I have to flee somewhere. And they're fleeing to the suburbs. And so they're paving all of these, they're creating all of these new highways and all these new infrastructures for people who are leaving Detroit. The problem with that, though, is it's causing irreparable damage to the ecosystems around Detroit that at one point, you know, when you pave over a land, that's, you're losing grassland, you're losing forest, you're losing a diverse ecosystem, and that's not part of the conversation. So even if you're driving a car that emits absolutely no carbon emissions, you're still having a really negative effect on the larger environment because roads are really problematic.
So, yeah, so in other words, it's kind of like we each want to get into our individual car and do our individual thing, and we're not thinking about the whole context, the whole infrastructure.
Why are we driving to begin with? Like, it kind of doesn't make a ton of sense in many cases to develop a system. I mean, there are tangible health effects to that. I mean, obesity and driving are very closely linked together.
There's also global warming has a health effect. You know, global warming has a health effect. Inhaling particulate matter has a health effect. Destroying the water supply to get more energy to run your car, that has a health effect. Having your food poisoned by the chemicals or, you know, the tar sands, or having people exposed to that who are workers, these all have health effects. And they also have larger environmental effects.
They definitely have health effects, but I was trying, what I tried to do with Greenwash is try to really narrow the scope to sort of the direct impact of our consumption. So when we're driving a car, we're very focused on sort of the tailpipe emissions, but we're not focused on sort of the whole infrastructure that it takes to support that. But that infrastructure is a direct reaction to our driving. I mean, LA isn't widening their highways because people are driving less. They're widening their highways because people are driving more.
And then what always happens in all of these things, and I'm just wondering, I just have to ask this, but, you know, what I've found, too, is that if you mention a problem, you point out, well, gee, you know, there's this myth that this is working for us, but look what's really happening here. Then people will turn around and kind of say something to the effect of, well, you can't point out a problem like this unless you have a solution. So I don't want to put that on you because I think you can't begin to find solutions until you've pointed out problems. You know, it kind of cuts both ways there. But what I'm hearing what you're saying is that, for example, living in an urban environment where you can take mass transport or building some form of mass transport, you know, would be a better way around this. So this is not a problem that's going to be, for example, solved by an electric car, even if we could get one. Is that right?
Right. And the paradox of the electric car and of hybrid vehicles in general is that they're most efficient in urban environments where other forms of transport make more sense. So I live in New York City, and in huge parts of the city, doesn't make a ton of sense to drive. And then in parts of the city, so I live in Queens, but sometimes I work in the Bronx on the weekends, and that's really difficult to navigate between. And so it makes a lot more sense to put pressure on the city to create mass transit routes that preference people's behaviors. So the Center for Urban Future in New York City released a report last year that showed that most of the growth in the past 10 years, and most of it had occurred in the outer boroughs, and that there's an increasing number in which people who, like, live in Queens work in the Bronx, or people who live in Brooklyn work in Queens. So there's a huge push right now for people in the outer boroughs to get directly to the outer boroughs without necessarily needing to go into Manhattan. But that isn't a conversation. But the way people are getting around that right now in the city is they're driving. And the city, to this day, is still prioritizing mass transit that gets people to Manhattan, even though more and more people don't necessarily need to get to Manhattan. And by focusing so much on how I, the individual, can get to where I need to get, and we're not having that kind of collective discussion, and people aren't doing the kind of work to put the systems in place that make it so that I don't need to drive.
Again, it's the same individual mindset. What are some other examples? We'll come back to talking about transport and energy and all of that in a little later in the show, because that's a big and very important topic. But let's just get a bit of an overview of, you know, what are some of the other things that where we think, oh, I'm making a difference because I'm purchasing or eating or not purchasing X, Y, or Z, and, like, you know, how those aren't helping or aren't really tackling the problem.
Sure. So one of the things that I like to talk a lot about is how we've come to the point where we conflate what's good for your individual health with what's good for the planet.
Right.
And one of the best examples of that is locally grown produce. And I buy locally grown, but in truth, the transportation footprint associated with agriculture is minimal. Most of the carbon emissions, most of the negatives associated with agriculture come from how we're raising our food, whether it be genetically modified or large fields of monoculture or factory farms. And in many ways, local helps get rid of those systems because, in general, as an individual, you're not going to drive up to your local factory farm and you know, buy a chicken. But it doesn't. The transport piece has absolutely nothing to do with it. So it's possible if you're buying from a local supplier that's not using sustainable methods to be just as toxic as, you know, using the traditional avenues of purchasing.
So in other words, it's really whether you buy sustainable, not that it's necessarily local. That's the biggest
right. So what comes out of buying local is transparency, right? So when you buy local, it's more possible for you to swing by the farmer and see how the things you're growing are grown. And the reason factory farms and a lot of negative agriculture practices have been able to thrive is because more or less most of us have no idea what's going on.
Right. That's true.
But the sort of the quantitative benefit from buying local isn't actually there, isn't actually supported if you look at transportation or how much agriculture or carbon emissions are released, because agriculture is a huge contributor to climate change and carbon emissions. But very little of that is transportation. So there are many excellent social reasons to buy local. And I'm not at all trying to malign buying local, but those reasons are not necessarily directly related to the environment.
Well, except if it's local, and like if it's a local chicken that's a free range chicken, and it's not raised in a CAFO, and it's not receiving antibiotics and hormones, and it's not, you know, I mean, those are different reasons. So that goes
that's a whole picture. It's not just the local sticker. So like if I'm living in North Carolina where there are many hog farms, and many of them are grown in very unsustainable ways, and I swing by my local hog farmer and buy, you know, pig, pork, I'm not being sustainable because it's local. It's not really benefiting the environment. Or if I go to Iowa and I buy corn from an Iowa farmer who has this huge crop of monoculture that's GMO raised, that's not sustainable either. Local is sort of like natural. It's a sticker that's stuck on things, and people sort of assume a bunch of things that come with that label, but it actually isn't really co-linked to any of those other things.
So, I mean, it also sounds like from what you're saying that part of what you're focusing on, because which I find very interesting, because I too am a native New Yorker and grew up in the city, and even though I've spent a great deal of time in the country in rural areas, in effect, there's a kind of an exurban myth of environmentalism, which is if we, you know, all moved into the country, we grew our own garden. We, you know, of course, there is some food security in that. You know, if one lived in the country, if one could earn a living, and one up in the country, one of the reasons people live in urban areas is for jobs. And you know, there are industries, businesses, and other things located, you know, concentrated in urban areas. But if perchance, you know, one had the wherewithal to go move to a rural area and grow your own food, you know, and then you'd be short there and all of that kind of thing. So the environmentalist myth is, you know, back to the land, back to the farm, back to the rural region. You know, if we all just made things simpler and didn't participate in these kind of mass infrastructures, many of which are run in a inhumane, health-harming and environmentally destructive manner, we'd all be better off, and that's so. Let's do a kind of takedown and make that happen. That what you seem to be arguing is actually that being in urban areas can be made to be more efficient, because of the concentration of people, and that we should be looking at that more and doing that kind of analysis. But it's not happening so much. I mean, is that a true characterization of some of what you're considering? And if so, what would be the advantages?
Right. So in some ways that is somewhat true. I think there's a ton of research that's been shown that in general sort of the best land use patterns are is a relatively dense urban core surrounded by an agricultural producing region. So we would sort of lose the suburbs that we've come to sort of worship at. And that has larger implications. And a relatively dense urban core doesn't necessarily mean Manhattan. It doesn't necessarily mean New York City. It can mean Portland. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are patterns of habitation that are relatively dense and, you know, not necessarily quite as dense as New York or Hong Kong. But at the core of all of it is our, the scale and the rate of our consumption. So one of the other subjects that I sort of take down in the book is sustainable fashion. So the rise of organic cotton and the rise of recycled polyester and all of these things. And on the surface, they're great. But the reality is that even while we're releasing these sort of green fabrics, the amount of clothes that we're consuming has skyrocketed. So H&M, for example, this year has released an organic cotton T-shirt, which sounds great on the surface, except for the fact that, one, while organic cotton does use fewer pesticides, it actually uses slightly more water, and a lot of organic cotton is grown in areas in, of the world that have very little water to spare. And so it's taking away from food production. At the same time, H&M creates clothes that are meant to be worn 10 times or less. So the pace of our, the amount of textile waste that's occurred in the United States over the past 20 years as fast fashion has emerged has skyrocketed. So it kind
I have a question. I'm a completely naive on this subject. You're saying that it's supposed to be worn 10 times or less? That's why? I mean, is the idea that you couldn't, you can't wash it because it will, you know, fall apart or the dyes will run? Or, I mean, why would anyone do that and why would anyone want that? I'm, this is completely new to me. Excuse my ignorance, but.
Okay, so it's not just H&M. There are a number of retailers. It's called fast fashion, and there are a number of retailers that sort of have this. Forever 21 is another one. There are a number of retailers that have this basic model. And the idea is that you make something, and you make something cheaply, and you make something super trendy. So you maybe can't go out and buy the runway model, you know, of a, you know, a Marc Jacobs T-shirt that costs $300. But you can go to H&M or you can go to Forever 21 and for $25 buy a knockoff, right? So you have this knockoff of this very expensive thing, but they deliberately make it cheapy and very cheaply and very trendily. So in 6 months you'll be back or in 3 months you'll be back and you'll need to buy something else. So it's a way for them to continue. It's a way of planned obsolescence. It's a way of getting you to continue to buy things. In terms of quality, it depends. Oftentimes, yeah, I mean, H&M, especially when they first came out, were sort of notorious for not being able to wash their clothes. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but just when you wash them a lot, they don't fit as well. They don't look as good. So you're sort of forced into buying something new, even if, you know, it isn't completely falling apart. But it is their business model, is to get people to continually buy new things. And so they design products that will encourage that behavior.
Wow, that's incredible. Okay, so now that I'm clear about that, go on and, I mean, so, discuss the implications of it. That's amazing.
So I think over the past 10, 20 years, the amount of textile waste in the United States has doubled or tripled. I have the exact number in the book. And while it's awesome in many ways that we've created organic cotton, the reality is that it might be just as good for us to continue using conventional cotton and to reduce the amount of cotton T-shirts we buy. So, like, that's sort of what gets lost in this whole picture, is that the scale of our consumption really does matter. And that's something else I talk about when I talk about food. So, obviously, food is a huge, I mean, it uses a large amount of land, it releases a ton of carbon emissions, there's a ton of fertilizer used in it, but 50% of the food produced in the United States is thrown out before consumption.
How does that happen?
Part of it is because Americans don't like food that doesn't look pretty, which is why there are baby carrots. That's what baby carrots are. They're ugly carrots that are shaved down and shaped. But another 40% of that, I mean, of the food that's thrown out, 40% of that food is thrown out once it comes into our home. So we buy food that we then don't use. And so when you want to, when you're looking at sort of the environmental implications of agriculture, well, yes, organic is wonderful and biodynamic is wonderful, and I've actually spent time working on organic and organic farms, and I don't know if I would be as willing to work on a conventional farm just because of the exposure to chemicals. These are all wonderful things. One of the easiest and fastest things that we can do to reduce the negative effects of agriculture in our environment is to get rid of the food waste.
And so is that something, again, is that individuals can do that at home? Is that something people should do on the people level, or are there other ways to that there are infrastructures that will support that or initiatives that will support it? How can that best happen?
It happens. It has to happen on both sides. On the human side, we need to cook the things that we buy. On the infrastructure side, there's an increasing push, for example, for supermarkets to be able to, and restaurants to give their food to a food bank. On the producer side, there's something called the ugly food movement, which is a huge movement to get people to buy fruit and vegetables that aren't as physically appealing but are completely edible. So
wow.
When you think about it and you go to the supermarket and you see the apples and they're all perfect, well, they didn't come off the farm perfect. There were ones that weren't perfect, and some of them end up in processed food, but a significant amount of it just gets thrown out.
We're going to go into our break here now for station identification, so please stay with us. We'll be talking more with Kendra Pierre-Louis, author of Greenwashing, on Connect the Dots. Come back after station identification. We've got a lot more to share with you. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, Green Health Journalist and Huffington Post blogger. You can find my blogs on healthjournalistblog.com. You're also warmly invited to follow me on Twitter at Allison Rose Levy and on Facebook, Connecting the Dots for Health. I do a lot of posting of health information, activism, environmental issues and developments because we're kind of you know, it's easy to get distracted by the noise of the presidential nominations and everything from a whole lot of laws and initiatives, regulations and policies that affect health and the environment and that will affect us that are going on concurrently. And I do a lot of posting on that as well as blogging about it on the Huffington Post, where you can also follow me and comment. On today's show, I am joined by the author of Greenwashing. Her name is Kendra Pierre-Louis, and she's highly informed and has a very interesting, I think, important take on how making a real difference in terms of slowing global warming, protecting our environment, living healthier, how all of that, yes, it can be helped, her book argues, by some personal choices, but a lot of myths of where we're making a big difference by consumer choice alone aren't working because we really haven't taken a bigger picture look at the infrastructures and the context for what we're doing and its real effects. We haven't really edited up to the bottom line. She has the background and training to do that and does it for us in this terrific book, Greenwashing, and we're talking with her about that now. Our topic was, and also just tell our listeners, if you would, Kendra, where can they get Greenwashing and where can they find out more about you and your work online?
Sure. The book is actually Greenwashed, Why We Can't Buy Our Way to a Green Planet, and you can find it pretty much where books are sold, so BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com. You can get ebook versions on iTunes, Kindle, what's the other one? The other e-reader. And you can find more about me at morethanstuff.com and also on Twitter at Kendra Wright.
Okay, terrific. Great. So now we were talking about organic cotton and designer clothes and as well as foods and how consumption is actually the problem in the way of clothing and in the way of foods when we paused for station identification. So, you know, let's return to that topic. You were talking about food waste and how so much food is wasted, and
right.
and you said there's a new ugly food movement?
Yes, it's an ugly food movement. It's sort of a fringe movement, but the idea that a lot of food is discarded because Americans have been sort of conditioned to only buy pretty fruit. And so the ugly, and while some of those shrewds that are discarded do make it into processed foods. A lot of them just end up simply thrown out. I actually knew people in Seattle who made deals with farmers to buy their ugly food at a discounted rate because the farmers couldn't otherwise make money off of them. And when I worked on an organic farm, actually, we had a freak hailstorm, and the farmer had to throw out an entire field of like collards and Swiss chard because nobody would buy them. Simply because they'd been hailed on, which is sort of silly.
Yeah, because actually, for kale or collards, it's almost like, you know, if you got them pounded, then they're more tender when you actually cook them. that could be an advantage. It could be a case of, you know, of nature doing the work for us. But you kind of have to think it through to get to that point if it looks slightly different. That's pretty interesting. Just give a tip or two about, like, when you go food shopping, like, what do you do personally, just to give people an idea of the little piece of what they can do, as well as where they can find some of these other initiatives and support them.
Sure. So I actually think that what I do when I go to the supermarket isn't as important as finding ways of connecting with and working with other organizations who are trying to push for larger transformative changes. So, for example, one of the other things that I do on the side is I actually volunteer with the White Roof Project, which is an organization based in New York City that's simple goal is to get everyone to paint their rooftops white. Painting rooftop white drastically reduces a building's energy use, and that actually has a bunch of other co-benefits in terms of making urban environments more livable, in terms of reducing the urban heat island effect and a number of other things. But it's a very simple thing. It's white paint on a rooftop. But yet we haven't done it. Most rooftops have dark roofs. And so those are the things that I think are really important. The fact that the organizations that you mentioned earlier that are working towards anti-fracking and towards getting around the systems, I think are really important. Because I think what's really happened, and a lot of why I wrote Greenwashed, is over the past 20 years, Americans have sort of transitioned from citizens to consumers. And I think that's why so much of the message about environmentalism has shifted from being social change and progressive change into this is something you can buy. And that's a framework that's really problematic because we're not going to be able to buy ourselves out of the kind of solutions that we need on a global scale in order to bring about, you know, to mitigate the negative environmental effects. Because it's not just climate change. And I think that's really important for people to recognize. The rate of biodiversity loss is stunning. The rate of desertification is off the chart. There's so many negative environmental things occurrences happening that are directly tied to our consumption and directly tied to human encroachment on habitats. That, yes, climate change obviously makes worse, but with or without climate change, the oceans would still be running out of fish.
And why are they running out of fish?
Because we're over we're overfishing. Herman Daly, who's sort of my Buddha, I guess, he wrote this excellent blog post the other day over at the Center for the Advancement of the City-State Economy about how it used to be that what the limiting factor of our consumption was our ability to extract the resources, right? So it used to be we couldn't get oil because we didn't have the technology to drill for oil on the ocean floor, for example, or we couldn't get fish because we didn't have boats that were big enough to go into the deep sea. But right now what's happening is there's a shift. We have the technology to do these things, but what's happening is we're running out of the resources. So it doesn't matter how big or how fancy your boat is when we don't have any fish in the water. You're not going to get any fish.
Or if the fish has been polluted by the deep water horizon spill or by radiation from Fukushima, for example. So,
right.
So
the limiting factor, which changed over the past 10, 15, 20 years, is that the limiting factor is no longer our technology, but our actual resources. We're running out of things.
So, you know, that's a really, I think this is a very important consideration, and it's one, I mean, this is where, this is what I run into a great deal in reporting on larger issues that require social action. For example, I've done a lot of reporting on the Toxic Chemical Safety Act and its complete inadequacy in regulating and monitoring chemicals appropriately. We wouldn't be having the concern about fracking which is a recent new process that deploys a lot of chemicals, except for the fact that it was exempted from Safe Drinking Water, Clean Drinking Water Act, Safe Air Act, and all of these other, you know, kind of standard right. regulations that no one else is exempted from. So, you know, some people don't like governments. Others, you know, don't think that what they can do is help. Others are too busy or concerned with whatever they're doing to kind of be following these kinds of things, which is, you know, part of our jobs is to help people stay tuned into these various things and follow them. Because, you know, some of these things we wouldn't have to be making individual choices and decisions if the infrastructures, if the, you know, the regulatory policies were protective of public health and the commons, if the infrastructures were really constructive rather than destructive, rather than depleting, rather than polluting, rather than harmful. But what seems to happen is that because we live in a time where there are so many of these mass infrastructures, people have been encouraged by, you know, the marketing climate of our time to just sort of purchase things, and that's, you know, all you need to do and that's what you can do. But it's also because they feel overwhelmed and automatically defeated
right.
when it comes to facing up to these infrastructures. And, you know, I always say if they face them sooner rather than later, and the sooner we face them, it's not going to get any better. So, like, before 2006, we didn't have the exemption of this new process, and if we hadn't elected that president, we wouldn't be coping with this right now. So, you know, at every, you know, before we had Citizens United, we had a better handle on who the politicians were really working for, the public good or powerful, you know, deep-pocketed industries of various kinds. So the more it continues, it's not getting better. It's getting worse. It's actually getting harder. And then this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where people are like, well, what I can do? What can I do? Nothing. Where 10 years ago they could have done more, and right now, 10 years from now, we might be looking back at today and going, oh, my God, if I'd only, you know, risen up with all the others and taken action on this, we'd be, you know, we'd be very much better now than we are now, because 10 years ago, meaning, you know, here in 2012, I didn't take action. So,
right.
you know, one of the things in communicating with the public is that about environmental issues is, you know, it's like, oh, you know, people are feeling overwhelmed, they're depressed, this is scary, it's frightening, they don't want to deal with it. You know, tell them something that makes them feel good, and obviously looking at all this is doesn't make anyone feel good, including you and me. how do we cope with that? I mean, how do we, I'm not saying we have to be happy, hopeful, you know, and make this into a joyride, that, you know, that may be unrealistic. But I mean, how do you find in, you know, in talking with your, is it just my generation, because I'm probably a generation or so up from you, is it just my generation that kind of is, some people are worried and some people are tuned out? I mean, how do you help people wake up?
So I think three things sort of need to happen. The first is I think it's really important for people to get back into nature, and I mean that quite literally. Like, the reason I work at the New York Botanical Garden, the reason why I spend a summer in grad school doing agricultural work is because I think it's very important for people to have a direct connection with natural systems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step. It's the most important, one of the most important things, to sort of get out there and get physically dirty.
Mm-hmm.
I think the next big thing that people need to do is they need to find one topic, and just one topic that sings to them, and get really involved in that topic. We're all juggling, you know, jobs and family and social commitments and, you know, the need to sleep. And so I definitely understand the limited time crunch that we're all working under, but there are also, I think part of that is also socially structured. Like, people have less time in part because of all these rollbacks in our human rights, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really important that people make time for one thing to get involved with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's working towards bringing about, you know, social change or environmental change, but something that they're passionate about and something that doesn't feel like work. And I think those two things have a really huge effect, sort of leading to the third one, which is sort of being really just broadly informed and broadly well-read. One of the things that I've realized in traveling a lot is that Americans really do know, we claim that we're really overwhelmed and so we tune out, but in some ways we know less about the world than almost anyone I've ever met. Like, I was being schooled in Nicaragua by, like, 16-year-olds on their understanding of American history, which was in some ways far more nuanced than my own. And, you know, and I was an adult in grad school at the time and felt kind of embarrassed. And I think that's something else that people should really work towards, reading multiple sources of information, even if that just means today you read this newspaper and tomorrow you read that one. I'm not suggesting anyone read 5 newspapers every day.
I think that actually, I like that approach. That makes it sound really, really doable. That makes it sound really doable. I think that's very smart. Now, one of the things we were talking about was, you know, what happens when you go to the supermarket? How do you, like, what do you tell yourself, or how do you, like, what kind of self-talk do you use to remind yourself to kind of consume less in these various dimensions? And also, one of the things that I think is hard for people getting started, like, I mean, I thought about this, actually, and I'll ask your opinion about it. Over the years of being a career woman, being a country person, being, you know, a work-at-home writer and journalist and all that kind of thing, you know, I have different clothes for different purposes. And, you know, I have a good bit of clothes. I've often thought, well, gosh, what should I do with these? I mean, I recycle them to my nieces and everything, but should I, like, be making quilts? I mean, out of them. I mean, you know, you can take them to, and I've done this, you know, to the used clothing store. Are people really going there to get this? So it's kind of like, if you're, one of the things that I think stops people from changing a pattern is that they've already been, let's say, bad forever. they've kind of already been bad, and so now they kind of almost feel like it's too late to be good. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. So it's interesting because clothing is funny. So one of the things about when you're talking about having multiple forms of clothing, I actually discourage people from giving to charity unless they know that it's going to stay in the country, because oftentimes when you give your clothes to charitable organizations, some of it they do sell. If it's in good condition and people in America would buy it, they absolutely do sell it in the United States. But a good chunk of it actually gets exported to developing nations, or it disrupts their textile industries and creates sort of other larger social problems. But one of the coolest things, and I talk about in the book, over the past few years to have emerged, is something called a clothing swap. And they're organized all over the city, all over the country, actually. And basically what happens is you bring all the clothes that you no longer want, and everybody else brings all the clothes that they no longer want, and they stick them into massive piles, and you go through them, and you pick out the things that you do want. And so it's an excellent way of sort of reusing clothing. That is still perfectly, you know, still wearable, and getting new out, quote unquote, new to you outfits, without having to consume more. And that's actually sort of, I guess, one of the best things you can do with it, because once you turn like your clothing into quilts and stuff, you're downgrading it, right? So you're taking something that was perfectly usable and turning it into something that then can, like, when the quilt starts to fall apart, what do you do then? So the idea is to try and keep it sort of upstream for as long as possible, and then when it's threadbare and falling apart and has holes in it, you cut it up and turn it into quilts.
And are there people doing the quilt thing? Because, I mean, I honestly...
I've
so
done
in other
it.
Words, there's you've done it. So there's actually... That's really great. So
because what do you do with all of those T-shirts that people give you for attending things?
Oh, my God, yeah. Or the bags. The little carry-on bags. I have tons and tons of, I mean, I use them to go food shopping with, but and the ones that look better, I take back to the next conference or the next business meeting. But yeah, there are and actually, I mean, obviously these little things are not going to make an enormous difference. And talk a little bit about, let's go back to the car thing, because we have another 7 or 8 minutes here before we have to close. And we began the show, for those who didn't listen to the first half hour of Connect the Dots, we began talking about how the automobile itself is a problem, not whether it's powered by oil, by gas, by electric, whatever it is, the individual automobile is not because of the cost of road building and the industrialization of areas where there are highways, and for other reasons too, it's not really the optimal way to get around. So, I mean, if you could, let's go big picture for a minute. If you could pie in the sky about what you'd like to see, how if you could wave a magic wand and make it happen, what would you like to see in terms of how we shifted our mode of transportation, and what kind of difference would that make?
I think ideally there would be sort of two. It would be one, cities would have multiple cores now, like in a way that they kind of don't. So it would be easier for people to live closer to where they worked.
Mm-hmm.
That would sort of be the first step. And then moving past it, I mean, I'm a big proponent of mass transit. I joke to people that I don't understand why people like to drive, because you can't drink and drive, but you can drink and ride the subway.
Well, there's an incentive.
there's
an incentive.
And that, I think, figuring out which transit patterns make sense is an extremely, and that's something I sort of get into in the last chapter of the book, about how when people talk about solutions and when people talk about creating change, ultimately solutions, especially when you're talking about environmental solutions, have to be extremely local and place-based, because mm-hmm. what makes sense, for example, we live in the Northeast. The Northeast has a ton of water. We get plenty of rainfall. So mm-hmm. using water as a resource makes a ton of sense. If you live in mm-hmm. Texas, using water as a resource doesn't make as much sense. You want to use water as a limiting factor, not as an expanding factor.
Mm-hmm.
So these sorts of solutions have to be place-based.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in Portland, and I was thoroughly entertained by bicycle commuters. I mean, I think bicycling is especially outside of, Canada, is a huge contributor to positive benefits and infrastructures. And bicycling and walking, apart from being good for the environment, also reduce crime.
Mm-hmm.
So they're wonderful co-benefits.
People are moving through the neighborhoods. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, it's really the thing that I'm getting overall from talking to you is that you're able to really connect the dots and be a big system thinker. I really agree with your notion that people need to adopt a cause and focus on it. I have many, obviously, but one of the things that happens when you adopt a cause, and it's not an argument against doing it, we absolutely need to do it. I'm totally in favor of it and everything. But one of the things that happens is that, it's really easy when you get immersed to see the world through the lens of your cause, your issue. And there are other things related to it sometimes. The fracking issue takes us into food as well as water, as well as politics, as well as renewable energy. There are some that have quite a broad dimension. Whereas, for example, stopping, buying and drinking from plastic drinking water bottles has a huge impact. Because it prevents the depletion of water, it creates new opportunities to recycle water, and it also gets rid of these horrible landfills and everything by that
right.
one simple action. So some causes, are by their nature kind of broad, and some are by their nature simple but very powerful and impactful. But the other thing that I feel people really mm-hmm. need is maybe to learn from, people like yourself and others of the younger generation that have not been, kind of immersed in this individualistic kind of mindset for their entire lives, to the point where it really becomes impossible to connect the dots. Because you just, as we're talking throughout the show, I'm just marveling and really enjoying the way that you're, linking this to that and looking at what the various impacts in multiple directions of every single thing that we're discussing, where all of that goes. And so it's actually that kind of thinking, that kind of broader immersion in larger topics, that kind of way of seeing and understanding reality and seeing ourselves in context, that really seems to me, as a way of looking at the world, to be so needed. And you obviously have cultivated this, which is why your insights are so interesting and valuable. How can people that, what are your favorite sites for people to read? What are your favorite authors? How can people develop the ability to get to big picture, broader thinking, which you recommend as the third point of how we kind of bring about a change in this regard?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, I don't, on the internet, definitely Tree Hugger. I'll have to, Grist, obviously. Grist.org. In terms of books, so many. Herman Daly, I love his economic theories. Mark Hertzgard wrote this book that was hugely influential to me when I was in college called Earth Odyssey. All of the sort of the classics, Natural Capitalism, Cradle to Cradle, tons of stuff by, Wendell Berry, obviously. I feel like everyone in my generation are like Wendell Berry groupies. But I think one of the big things is that my generation, we've sort of started to recognize that there are lots of problems that are far, that we spent a lot of time struggling alone with and realizing that other people had the same problems. And I think the rise of the internet has made it really easy for us to come together and to connect with each other. And I think that's sort of the difference.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That is a big difference, isn't it? Yeah. So there's a saving grace in being able to connect via the internet. I mean, people are listening to us right now via the internet, or they will be listening to us in archives. And also, you know, in sites and in communities and where people can really kind of join together and share. And it also, I think part of how we got there, I really agree with you, is due to, you know, kind of learning that everything has to be done in isolation. You know, we can be the greatest success on earth and, you know, hit the jackpot in America, or we can be marginalized in a corner somewhere, you know, without, you know, kind of entering the mainstream or something. And, you know, both potentials are there. And the latter one, because of the lack of safety nets, the individualism in our culture and everything, is so frightening that naturally, you know, people are going to the former, and that's really part of the source of the greed that is part of the problem and serving as an obstacle from us getting to the caring social solutions and far-sighted thinking that are needed to create these kinds of infrastructural changes. So I just want to thank you so much, Kendra, Pierre-Louis, for being with us. And, you know, your book is absolutely terrific, Greenwashed, must read. You know, go look for it on Amazon and elsewhere online, you know, listeners. And, you know, I just thank you so much for the work you're doing, for being, you know, for really thinking in these ways. And I'm going to have you back on the show again, because we need, you know, big system, big picture thinkers like you coming along here. And, you know, thank you so, so much. And, you know, keep on keeping on. Your work is great.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Delighted. So stay tuned next week, listeners. We'll be back with Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Wednesday Eastern Times every week on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and thank you for listening.